First of all, welcome to 100 Proof. I still hear the, there we go. We had that great little intro music running for a little bit. I saw you doing the little...
There is something catchy about that little
riff. It's good. You know who made... Is that the Creative Commons of the Nine Inch Nails track? I think it is. I think that is...
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. He launched a whole album, CC Zero.
You're kidding me.
No, it turns out people do like CC Zero.
Let's go.
Some people do. Happy Friday, Amanda. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
On the other side of the office, it's great to have you here. Of course, going to be checking in with the community, reading the vibes, seeing what's going on, and we always love your commentary as well. So please chime in whenever. And same goes for Sam, NFT Stats in the house. Sam, it is good to have you here. You're muted though. We still can't hear you, but you look good. Try one more time. What are you saying, Sam? Sell everything?
He's
doing some type of sign language. The floors are falling. Something. He's trying to tell us something. We'll get back to Sam. He's working on his audio issues. If I had to stack rank audio issues, Sam's at the top. Never had anybody with more audio issues than Sam.
Hello?
There we go.
We got him back.
You got me. Let's go, everyone.
Sorry. Let's go, Sam. Friday. Let's go.
Happy Friday.
I got to snap out of this. Let's go.
All right.
It's good to see everyone.
It's good to see you too, man. This is awesome. We got the crew together. Shoe check in. How we doing, Derek?
Let's shoe check in.
What do you got?
I got my kicks on.
Better socks than me, man. You always have better socks. I got the plain black ones.
I'm not going to lie. I have better socks than you.
You do.
I was actually just chatting with Amanda and CT right before the show. Everybody's minting their Jenner sweaters, and we were talking about these socks, and why can't we have Jenner socks?
I was just going to say, are those like a Chromie Squiggler or some shit that we don't know about?
They look kind of like a hyper fuzzy. Anyway, it got the wheels turning.
Love it. All right.
Yeah. I mean, I already pitched that idea to Eli, so if you do it, we have to work together because I've already given the idea to him.
Amanda, how you doing? Let's check in with the community team first, and or the community in general on Discord and the Twitters. What's the vibes like this morning?
In the Twitters, Kevin? On the Twitters, everything is going good. I see some familiar faces in the audience now. Shant, one of our fave, PC and Moonbirds, fellow Royal Bird. Hello. Hey, Gribbs. Gribbs always wants a shout out, so I have to say hi. Victor and Steve. And Wayne, who is somebody who's on the fence about getting a Moonbird, and I hope you might want to get one in the next couple of weeks. That'll be fun. We got Victor. We got Mate. Hello, everyone. Welcome.
Yeah, happy Friday, y'all. And if you're in the Discord or the YouTube chat, please come say hi. We'd love to have Amanda, if there's any pressing questions you have, we'll just interject them into the show, and that'd be fun. All right. So crazy last few days for me.
This is what I heard. I actually was in the punks telegram the other day, and I saw that there was some big stuff happening in there with you involved.
Yeah, it was. So one of the things that I saw that there's some chatter. So I hadn't been in there in a while, and the punks telegram is awesome. Like they have such an insane group of great collectors and early adopters of this stuff. It's I would say that in like the Art Blocks community Discord, that one channel. What's that one channel called?
Block Talk.
Yeah, Block Talk.
Yeah.
Those two are like the OG groups that like, you know, where everyone goes.
They're still, I mean, like both of those are just nonstop feeds.
Yeah.
Just synchronous conversations every hour of the day.
So yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
So I was on the Telegram one, and I was like, oh, I should check in and see what's going on with the punks. And I noticed a few people had added me, and you know, a couple people were like, I don't think he minted the first day of punks, and the saying I hadn't actually minted.
So people don't know this about you. Like people don't know how early you were to NFTs.
Well, I don't want this to be so here's the thing. The most important thing is that nobody knew these were going to be NFTs, right? It was just right place, right time. And a buddy said, hey, go check this out. There are these things called CryptoPunks. They're on the blockchain. You should collect them. And one of the things I've always said is I don't remember whether I actually minted them or not. I think I did, but I just didn't remember because
it was a claiming.
It was a claiming, and you weren't calling it minting back then. And then I remember they were for sale. There was some type of marketplace or something. I don't remember if I paid. I on a few podcasts I said I think I paid $10 for them. Anyway, some people are like, they couldn't find my wall, 'cause there were only 300 people that did it the first day. And I couldn't, I just, you know, I lost my wallet and all that. I found the wallet, I found the private keys. I was able to get my 10 punks out of there, blah, blah. And so I really wanted to like squash some of the FUD. And so I was like, hey, like, here's my wallet. You tell me. 'Cause like it's not a standard. They weren't like standard NFT tokens back then. This is before the standard was designed. And so I even looking at the smart contract data, I'm like, it says claims. I think I minted it. And then finally people were like, okay, cool. Like you minted it. And then one insanely helpful, awesome member of the community was like, hey, you have some V1 punks in there that you never wrapped. And so you're sitting on 10 V1 punks. And for people that don't know about CryptoPunks, what happened is they had launched them, and then you could claim them. And then they immediately found a bug in the contract. And so they killed that and relaunched them and airdropped people the new V2 punks, which is now the official collection. They said V1's dead. That was a mistake. We're sunsetting it. V2's the real deal. A lot of people, or some people, go back and look at that V1 and say, well, that was the very first one they did. And they later have, you know, tied the art to it by wrapping it and pointing to the actual art because the art was disconnected from it and wasn't being rendered. So there is a smaller market for a lot of the V1 punks. Like they trade it right in 3.5 ETH, something like that, close to 4 ETH.
They trade as like these like quirky artifact collectibles as part of like, it wasn't the artist's intent, but there is like a non-zero value that people have because there's like these live on a blockchain and they were this, you know, artifact that existed when Larva Labs was deploying the project. And so there's some value there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a story there to be told. It's interesting and there's some value there. And I had no idea that these were even sitting there. My buddy that told me to go mint these, I call him up and I'm like, dude, do you know about your V1s? He's like, what are you talking about? I haven't looked at punks in forever. And he opened up his wallet. He found 22.
Wow.
Because he was like really into it. And then I had another friend that I had told to go mint him and he found one. So it's like, it's pretty awesome. It was like, awesome. It was a little bit of found money there. And so I have now 9 V1 punks. I gave one away to the person that helped me find them, which is really awesome. And it was a little bit of a process. You had to take it and transfer it to another contract and wrap it and all that and then eventually get it out. But
your wallet hacked a couple times in the process.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, always hot wallet only. You know how I roll. And so,
hey, Kevin, I have a very important message from the audience.
Please.
Someone says you need to give Stevie one of those V1 punks.
Wow.
That's what
wow.
I heard.
How did they
that's
say what, that? I can't, just randomly.
That's it.
Just said it.
Randomly. I have to say everything that everyone says. And so I think you have to also do what everyone says. So
yes.
There's that.
Well, you have my hot wallet keys, so you can just do it yourself. I just hand those around the office. That's so
true. That's true. we all know that you're not so secure. No, I'm just kidding. Somebody does say in the audience, Phosphorus, too soon. I'm so sorry. I apologize. Phosphorus in the audience says, happy birthday, punks, which is true. Today is their 6th year anniversary of Mint. So it's actually quite fitting that you found your V1 punks this week.
So crazy. Six years,
know that,
man.
Today? Yeah.
Like yesterday.
They're so far ahead of every like other NFT ago. Project. Like, I think, you know, Bored Apes just, they just celebrated 2 years a few months ago. So I cannot believe that, like, that there's 4 whole years between any sort of, like, real significant NFT PFP project.
Yeah, so crazy. Wild. There was that whole down period for quite some time. But, yeah, anyway, I just wanted to share that story. I thought it was a wild one. I know we've got a lot of stuff to cover today, including probably the one that is hitting a lot of people, not directly in the NFT pocketbook, but certainly in the concern and realm of all things crypto, which is what's happened with the SEC and Binance and also Coinbase. Some pretty big news there.
Yeah, I can give some broad strokes, and then I'd love to hear, we can go around the horn and just hear how folks are interpreting this and what it may mean. Like, this is a digital object NFT podcast. We should talk about what it means for NFTs.
Yes.
But in general, the SEC, which is a U.S. Regulating entity here, the Securities Exchange Commission, brought and accused Binance and Coinbase, two of the largest global crypto exchanges in the world, with operating securities exchanges and selling digital assets that should have been registered. And so I think it's important to take a step back and convey that The SEC is, you know, they have a hammer. They have a single tool, and that tool is really meant to protect investors, and it's meant to make sure that fraud doesn't exist in the market, and it's really to regulate and operate around the securities classification, which is Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Act of 1934, and the case law that has been created around, you know, the rules from those acts over the last, let's call it, you know, 90 years, which we call like stare decisis, just like case law around this stuff. Mm-hmm. And the truth is like we're now dealing with an internet technology, these digital assets that don't quite conform to securities, like securities law. Like these laws were written close to 100 years ago. And a lot of the case law that exists around this stuff is, you know, it's just like a little bit orthogonal to how digital assets work or what their purpose is or why these networks form, or even the fact that this is an internet global technology and the SEC's jurisdiction is the United States of America. And so it's been, you know, I think there's nothing shocking here. This has been a tension that's existed for a long time. Is like, how do governments and regulating forces work with this technology? Because it's so different than anything that was ever articulated before in our country's lawmaking system, and figure out a way to protect consumers and protect, you know, individual citizens. And so this, you know, I think knowing that there needs to be, I think the SEC is taking the approach like, listen, we're a securities regulator. We could make the argument that some of this stuff is securities. We're going to do that. And so they're taking a point of view that Coinbase and Binance and things like this are, because these things are digital assets and because they kind of look like they are being traded similar to how public equities are being traded, they're taking the opinion that those should be classed and regulated like securities. Now, I think there's you know, a question as to even that's whether that's the right approach. I think this has been the big tension is Ether or is Bitcoin like a security? And I could sit here and make very compelling arguments that those things don't exist. And if those things as securities, if those things don't exist as securities, well, can you make those same arguments for the hundreds of other objects or assets that exist in our space? And I think, you know, this tension is now starting to come to bear and the SEC is taking a point of view, and Coinbase has, this is not shocking to them. This is a conversation ongoing that they've been having for a very long time. And I'm sure Binance has as well. And I think now we're going to start to see it move into the judiciary and the court system to let them kind of sort through this. It's going to take a long time. It's a years long process to kind of hear arguments and weigh out what's going on. And my hope is this is really a job for legislators. Like this shouldn't really be the SEC's within the realm of their jurisdiction. They are a regulating force for securities law. We really do need great lawmaking here by Congress and our legislative branch to create and articulate new rules for how digital assets and the different classifications of digital assets should be regulated in the U.S. So my hope is while this thing is getting sorted out, we actually are able to see compelling legislation come to bear here in the U.S. and we can take a stand as a country and really start laying out how the U.S. can be a pivotal force in this new emerging technology through lawmaking.
Yeah. One question for Sam, and then we'll jump over to Amanda. But I'm curious, Sam, when we see news like this comes out, it's like shocking to the crypto markets. Like typically, if something bad happens to Coinbase that's substantial or Binance, you know, you see a sell-off in some of these assets. Does that, Sam, are you seeing that trickle down to NFTs as well? Like, is there kind of additional effects that are hitting floor prices of projects, or do we really not see an impact there?
Not really. You know, I think when ETH makes huge moves, you know, that tends to have a big impact on NFTs. You know, so if ETH were to have gone down 20%, but ETH wasn't mentioned as a security in this, I think ETH, the whole crypto complex took a bit of a hit and then rebounded pretty quickly. So broadly speaking, you know, I think the ecosystem that we're involved in did not really react all that negatively. I think we're still in a world where so much of at least the floor prices for the PFP market, which is the most liquid one, is still so much determined by Blur and, you know, Blur farmers and bidders and liquidity providers that they, you know, I think if those players were to step away, and there are 5 to 10 of them, if they were to step away, yeah, that would lead to a huge, huge move in floor prices and have a big impact. But we didn't, I don't think we saw any of that. I think the market, I mean, the ETH market didn't really shake. The ETH prices is still kind of in that 1800 to 1900 range. And NFTs, I'd say, if you look at kind of like a floor price chart, I don't think you really saw a lot of movement on the back of this. And stuff like ARP blocks, you know, it's just much less liquid. So you don't get quite as much day-to-day information there.
Amanda, love to get your thoughts on this as well. Like, how are you seeing things shake out, both personally? How do you feel about this? And then also, you know, any community reactions as well? Oh, we can't hear your audio for some. No audio from Amanda. She's saying community is freaking out.
It's not just me.
Well, yeah.
Can you hear me?
There we go. You're back.
There we go. All right. So what I was saying is that the Binance news is a little concerning personally, just the fact that withdrawals and deposits seem to be kind of touch and go right now. So, but honestly, like, I'm like, well, my JPEGs are safe, right? If I can't even like sell my ETH to off ramp it off to somewhere else, I might as well just keep it in JPEG. So I'm fine. But we've got some good conversation going on in the community. Somebody says, Phosphorus says, let the regulation happen and usher in the next bull run. Test Tube Ted says, the tech and market innovation is simply too fast for any policy making to keep pace with, in his opinion. So I think that's an interesting sort of dichotomy of thoughts there of, you know, let the regulation happen. But other people think that we're moving way too quickly for regulation to actually have any big impact. Let's see, we've got Shant who says, I've heard from very credible sources that Coinbase is in a very strong position, but this will be a long road, maybe 2 to 3 years till resolution. So, you know, we have some time here. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, the one thing that Brian Armstrong, the CEO of Coinbase, tweeted out, which I have up here on the screen, is you'll see that he said there is no path to, quote, come in and register, end quote. We've tried repeatedly so that we don't list securities. Like, this is the kind of jacked up thing that's happening with the SEC. They're like, well, these need to be registered. They don't even have a path to do that. So they're just going after. And then, like, the thing that I'm most confused about is, like, how are they throwing a lasso around these currencies? Like, they pulled Solana into it. They pulled, like how are they deciding one versus the other? Like,
it's a great question.
You know what I mean? Like, it seems like they're just randomly selecting coins.
It definitely feels like there's a little bit of an overreach happening. I mean, even to create lines around the ones they named and the ones they didn't, it just demonstrates that I think there's a fundamental lack of understanding as to, like, you know, how lines should exist or where lines should be. And these projects look so different from one another. It's really difficult for me to see a through line between these things that have been lassoed in, as you say. The other thing I'll echo is, it wasn't just Brian, you know, Robinhood also mentioned the same exact thing. They spent 16 months with the SEC. They came in, they tried to register, they tried to understand what does it mean to have a regulated brokerage for digital assets. Is it a special purpose broker dealer? Is it an ATS? What do we need to do? And after 16 months, they just got dropped by the SEC and said, we're not going to be able to help you. And so if that's what, you know, the buzzsaw that projects are walking into, it's like, well, what, there's something is fundamentally incorrect with the work here that's being done by the SEC. It's just not working. And at the end of the day, like, we really got to get this out of their hands and get this in instead of regulation by enforcement, move it really to a system where the people are able to, you know, vote in legislators who are then able to embody their interests and actually create laws that avail the U.S. to the demands of what modern, you know, the modern economy is wishing for and wants. And so this, my view is, like, this really needs to get out of the regulation bucket into the legislation bucket. And the faster and sooner we can do that, the more we'll be able to grok with these difficult issues about where lines should exist for digital objects and digital assets.
Yeah. I'm really curious to see, of the coins that get looped into this, if it impacts their NFTs at all. Like, it'll be curious to track Solana-based NFTs. You know, not that this is the end for Solana, not by any stretch, but it's just like, it is a form of FUD against them to say, like, the SEC is going after this particular coin, you know, for no apparent reason.
I'll note a couple of things. Like, at the end of the day, it's a global internet technology that's being used and referenced by people who don't live in the US. So like this, the technology that Solana has created will continue to persist.
Yes,
just
of course.
Like the technology for Bitcoin and Ethereum and a lot of these layer ones will continue to persist because they're being used by people that don't live in the US. So regardless of whether the classifications look a certain way, I just think from a functional perspective, these things are going to continue. Like Ethereum is going to continue to produce blocks. These things are going to continue to get used and referenced, and objects will get stored as on these public databases. I guess the question is one of like, well, what is like the effect on price? And that's one like I'm not totally clear on yet. But what I will say is like NFTs, and we've talked about this a lot, serve such a different role than like the world of securities and public equities and reporting. And these things are just products and, you know, services or objects that we store value in, like fine art. And so I think the market is even pricing these totally different, which to Sam's point is why we probably haven't seen anything. There's not like a halo effect around this, a negative halo effect
right.
that's happening.
It's just, well, that's actually a really good thing.
Yeah,
right.
Which is
like,
a great thing.
It's like if these are getting hit on by the SEC, it's nice to know that as collectors, we can all say, okay, well, at least, you know, knock on wood, right now it's not having an impact on the JPEGs that we own, right? Like it's kind
of. I think
of...
that's a good point. I think like the market is smart enough to know that the SEC bringing a lawsuit as to whether or not Coinbase is a unregistered broker dealer has nothing to do with the value of owning fine art. Like those,
right.
The market is like, you know, pretty sophisticated in understanding that these aren't quite the same thing.
Yeah. I was going to ask you one unrelated question, but somewhat related. Speaking of other chains and NFTs, have you done any ordinal collecting at all yet?
So I've done a lot of ordinal research, and I've talked to a lot of the teams that are building over there. I've done some dabbling, but I wouldn't call myself an ordinal or an inscriptions collector. I think what's going on over there is super interesting. I love experimentation. I love innovation. I love the fact that Bitcoin is modernizing and that there is a fee market that's developing that can help the chain persist. I like that there's this weird constraint around, you know, being able to upload X amount of size of image or data directly to the Bitcoin blockchain. It's just like a very cool feature. But that constraint isn't going to be used by 99.9% of creators.
Yeah.
It will be used, and I think there's tons of value that can get created around it, but it's not the end-all be-all of all value. It's a piece in a much larger puzzle of like the work that we're all doing here, and I think there's going to be some amazing work that lives on the Bitcoin blockchain through this mechanism, but there's so much else that's going on outside of the inscriptions and ordinal space.
Yeah, I talked to yesterday. I had a call with the founder of OnChain Monkey, who's doing a lot of stuff in this space.
Yeah,
they've always been really early innovators on in terms of what they've gone after. He's available to meet up next week and chat. We might have him pop in on the show and just talk about some of the stuff they're launching
awesome.
Next week, which would be pretty cool. All right, so let's move on to the next story. Before we do though, let's check in with the community and check in with Amanda. What's going on over there?
Yeah, I think you know, we've just had more conversations and more comments about everything that you guys are talking about, and I think that it's important to sort of note the difference between what is the risk here. Is this the risk at those coins or the risk towards those platforms, right? So we've got some people, we've got Zilla in the chat, we've got DJ in the chat saying, you know, Binance is no shock. It's a nothing burger. Binance US and US in general is always kind of not really loved Binance. So they're not shocked about this. But I think that there is, you know, a little bit more uncertainty about, you know, what does this actually mean for them deciding to target Solana or all these other coins, right? So I think that's an interesting point for sure. Shant says the enforcement arm of the SEC is also not communicating with the operations arm. Brian is right that come in and register doesn't make sense. It isn't possible.
Yep. Well, thank you for all that feedback and keep it coming. Let's move on to the next story. We had a really kind of amazing week of releases from Apple and announcements.
Like, so awesome.
Across the board, I thought the entire portfolio of things that they're announcing with the 15-inch Air and all that, we're obviously not a tech variety show, so we don't have to go into all that. Totally. But I thought it was a good, well-rounded update from them. And of course, the star of the show was the, you know, the Apple Vision Pro, which was just shockingly compelling to me.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Dude. Let's unpack it. So it's great. So I totally agree. It was awesome. I'm curious, like, what caught your eye? Because I feel like you, of all people, you are someone who's been so close to technology over the last 25 years. You're just like front and center. It's been a huge part of your life and your work. I'm curious. You've said in the past that you've been more bearish than most on immersive tech and XR and things like this. What switched for you?
Yeah, I mean, several years ago, when at the height of all VR investing, I was like just avoiding it like the plague. Yeah. And the reason primarily was because it just it seemed like a little bit premature, both in terms of price point, size, and especially the social dynamics of it, because I pay attention a lot to the commentary around technology and how the coolness and public perception factor of a piece of tech. I'll give you an example. When the Segway came out, it was like the dorkiest thing to be seeing people with a helmet on riding around a Segway, right? And I remember being like, yeah, those aren't going to sell, you know? And like, but it was the hype, like everybody, Segway's the future, everyone's going to be using them, blah, blah, blah. It was a seriously overhyped piece of tech. And I felt the same way when I saw VR. I was just like, it was embarrassing. Everyone was filming their friends doing stupid shit and how dumb they look. And I'm like, this just doesn't feel like the right time for this tech. It's like something about this isn't right. And so I was always thinking it was going to be augmented reality. And I did a blog post about this. Yeah. Not necessarily Google Glass. Cause I was very lucky to have I was at Google when they were developing Glass, and I went into X, which is where the top secret lab. I got a tour, which was really a crazy story.
You kind of have to tell it, dude.
Well, I mean, I don't like to tell these stories because it sounds like you're name dropping and all that shit. But Sergey took me into X and showed me the Glass before it came out.
So awesome!
And so I got a chance to actually wear it and play with it. And I remember thinking like, interesting, but yet another one of those things where I took one home and they gave me one when they first started giving them out to Googlers, like they had a batch of 100 or something. I took one to a party and I remember just being like, I look like such a fucking dork in this, with these things on, right? It just didn't seem right. But when I saw the Apple device, I was like, they nailed it in that they didn't make it seem like a solo experience. Like you can see the person through it. If there's a pass through, which is so key.
Yeah.
Like they didn't have to do that, but they understood that if you are interacting with an outside environment in real time, a dog runs up, a child runs up, the doorbell is rung, like so many different things can happen where it's a struggle. And so Apple is just so good at saying, here's a rough edge, here's something tough, and I want to sand it down. So anyway, I think that the way that Apple approached it is less about get up and work out and have exercise games and do all that. And it's more about a better theater experience, a better way to kind of view media, which for me gets me really excited about NFTs, right? It gets me excited about the metaverse that could be more of an AR versed, based metaverse than VR. And so there's a lot here that's pretty exciting. And, you know, It was fun to see really some of these people come out and talk about how this just wasn't Apple playing catch up, but they've actually been working on this for a long time. So Sterling Crispin came out and did this long tweet, and he's an Artblocks coder, and as you know, has been on Super Rare and Foundation, and spent 9+ years working in AR and VR, and he was working on this project and said, and Apple has been working at this for about a decade now, which is crazy because that puts it like pre Facebook acquisition of Oculus.
Yeah.
So this isn't an afterthought. This isn't a let's play catch up. Like I saw this at Google so often where there was a reactionary thing where they would see a device get dropped and be like, oh shit, all hands on deck. Let's spin up a team of 150 people and go tackle a new industry that we just didn't even see coming. Apple clearly saw this coming and has put a ton of time into this device.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty excited. I think it's going to be a hit.
I totally agree.
It's expensive.
But I think I'll just piggyback on your last point, which is like this has been a huge de-risking event for immersive technology and XR and AR and VR. And when you see the world's leading consumer technology products company, putting this much work, this much time. I mean, like the being able to see somebody's eyes while they've got the goggles on is the person who owns the object, the goggles themselves, will never appreciate that. It's for everybody else.
Yes, exactly.
That attention to detail is insane. They built a screen. It's also not their eyes. It's a screen that's showing their eyes. Like, think about how much detail went into deciding to put an extra screen in just so the people around you could be part of the experience as well. And so from a, I think about these things in terms of like very pivotal de-risking events for hardware manufacturers, for developers who want to start building in this tech stack, for people who want to understand why, you know, immersive digital is the next frontier. Apple planting a flag with a device like this is a huge de-risking event, and one that I think will shape culture and society in very meaningful ways that have still yet to be determined.
Yeah, 100%. So. And we should mention that, speaking of this whole thing coming together, this Sterling Crispin guy that has helped develop this, Eli is actually interviewing him and is going to have him on Proof. So we're going to actually have an interview with this engineer as well, which I think will be pretty awesome. But yeah, I mean, this is essentially Apple doing what it does best, which is like, they oftentimes release very new tech at the higher end of the spectrum and then work their way backwards. Mm-hmm. And many companies have done this. Like Tesla started off with the Roadster, which was a very expensive $100,000 plus car at the time, which at that time was insanely expensive, and worked their way backwards once the components got cheap enough, right?
Yes.
And so that's what Apple is doing here. And we've seen this time and time again. They did it with the studio display. They started off with a $4,000, I think it's still $5,000 studio display. Now they dropped it down to the very approachable one. So I would imagine this just is going to be a series of devices. And eventually the sweet spot here is about the price of an iPad, I think, is where you need to get it.
Yeah.
All right. So, but what this begs the question, though, I'm really curious is, like, you know, we started and we talked about this at Flamingo DAO on our call this week, is are there assets now in NFTs specifically that will play well in this world that are worth collecting now before this thing really pops and takes off, right? Yeah. Like we talked about this with the AI art, you know, 8 months ago or whatever it may be.
This immersive 3D XR art, whether it was created using, you know, XR like XR gear, or whether it can be enjoyed in XR, AR, VR, does this see some sort of like a tailwind in terms of collectability? I think the answer is overwhelmingly yes. But I think like the trick is like, okay, well, what are those other narratives that make these things stand out and important as collector's items or as artists who have been, you know, working at their craft for so long in these verticals? Do you have, it was a fun conversation in Flamingo. I'd be curious to hear, do you have any thoughts, like early thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because we have yet to see where these things will be displayed and how they will be displayed and appreciated in that environment. You know, and if it is something where there is a world where they can easily be placed and displayed and it's something that a lot of consumers go to, then that is pretty interesting to me. And I think it'll be kind of, you know, prescient to like say, I collected these early on or these were some of the earliest pieces.
Yeah.
You know, there's been some artists that have been dabbling in creating this stuff for a while. Joy being one of them that I have here up on the screen. Early artist that was doing a lot of 3D stuff that is compatible with these worlds, which is really interesting. He actually uses an Adobe product that you can use in the Oculus to actually build sculptures, which is I'm going to try out because it just sounds like a lot of fun. I know Flamingo holds some of these, right?
Yep.
Flamingo's a collector here, and then you actually had a really interesting take on this. Do you want to talk us through your thesis?
I will. I want to hear from Sam. Sam, what's your gut? Because Sam has a nose for this stuff. He's usually my BS detector. What's your sense on this, Sam?
I mean, I think a couple things. I think one, the idea that suddenly people start living in metaverses and whatnot, like I think that's all still a long way away.
Yes.
And the other thing is, even if we do move to a metaverse, are the big platforms like Apple or the big players going to want to start bringing in decentralized technology? Whereas we haven't seen those universes do a lot of that with our MacBooks, right? Like, you know, Meebits could show up in a lot of software on my MacBook right now, but the big players have ring-fenced those worlds and decided not to bring NFTs in that much. So I think that gateway is still there for this. I think the 3D thing is interesting, though, if it just becomes a world, call it, and it doesn't even have to be metaverse. It just has to be like your typical operating experience is more in a 3D environment than maybe some of these then maybe 3D collectibles do become more interesting, not because suddenly you're off in a metaverse, but just because your operating system and the way you interact with Word or internet or Chrome or whatever it is, you know, happens to be in a more 3D immersive environment, that this art takes a different look. So I can see a world where 3D gets more relevant. I think the steps towards now we have to all go buy Meebits or whatnot, I think we're still a few steps away. And I think a lot of the bigger gateways that have prevented that from being relevant in the big platforms, like, I think they still exist even in a 3D immersive hardware world.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing I'm curious about is, I feel like one of the things that Apple is so good at is when they have a defining technology, they tend to bridge it across the entire ecosystem of Apple, right? So like, if they build something awesome on iOS, it makes it its way to a version of it, makes its way to Apple TV, a version of its way makes it to the iPad OS. And, you know, it's like, I have to believe that if there are some breakout moments that happen with this new device, that this tech is then propagated and pushed into their other devices in their own unique ways, right? So meaning if there is some type of 3D world, a 3D environment where we are enjoying digital objects, I have to imagine that makes its way to the iPad and to the iOS devices as well. And that is when I think you get pretty, it gets interesting, because now, and I can take these with me in some capacity. But I do like what you said here, Derek, and you know, you and I are big fans of, like,
Crate digging,
dumpster diving, whatever you want to call it. We would like to find the origin of stuff. Tell us about this collection and why it's meaningful to you in the world of 3D.
Yeah, so one of the first, I think there's a couple. I mean, Decentraland and Voxels were like kind of, you know, really started to kind of get popular at the same time. But those two were really the first. And CryptoVoxels took this very opinionated Voxels viewpoint on their 3D immersive environment. And so back in the day, I mean, they had this other contract. So you could create spaces and voxels and the plots would sell. And but they had this other contract, this 1155 contract called Voxels Wearables. And artists could create wearables that could then be enjoyed inside of CryptoVoxels. And they are rigged in 3D and ready to go. And a bunch of the OG artists would mint work on this contract. Now, this is before, you know, crypto art was a thing and people were, you know, collecting these artists, but there's artists like Josie and Xcopy.
Yeah, this is Josie right here. I'm going to add some Coldies in here. So yeah. So look at these Coldie glasses.
Those are fun.
So your point is that this is some of the blue chip artists that we know and recognize today on all these other platforms that have created early 3D objects that if a 3D world does take off, or some version of 3D, you know, via Apple or other devices, and these are a lot of ifs here, yeah, and if they are compatible with those worlds, these will be collectibles in their own right, because they were created by, you know, the Hackatows, the Josies, the Xcopies. You can see a lot of blue chip artists on this list.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, I like collecting stuff from these artists in general, and I like going back and finding their old artifacts. And so I just think there's a collectability to owning a 1 of 10 Xcopy edition visor, or like a Josie spray paint bottle in 3D. Like, I just like those artists and I want to support them and I like to collect them. But I also think there is something interesting about this, you know, relegated to the dustbin old 1155 contract for 3D immersive assets, seeing some tailwinds as we move into a world where you can actually start to rig this stuff on your avatar. And because it all exists as ownership tokens on chain, possession over these digital objects and being able to bring them into new environments becomes feasible. And so I love this kind of stuff. I love crate digging, as we call it. And I think there's some fun artists that you can kind of go back here and see some experiments that were run.
It's funny. I was like, which one is the Xcopy? And I see one listed for 17.99 ETH. 33 grand. Of course, that's the Xcopy visor here. I mean, this is, I think the major, one of the things that I've always seen true is, it oftentimes in the world of collectibles, this is like 90%+ of the time, it's always the forgotten stuff that people look back on and be like, there was that period where I could have gotten them for X had I just been there at the right time, right moment. You know, I hear that story over and over. I've seen it repeated over and over as it applies to a whole slew of different types of collectibles, whether it be physical or you name it. And this might be one. So that's interesting.
Fun one. It's a fun one for sure.
Yeah. Let's check in with Amanda real quick. Amanda, your thoughts on this stuff, and are you buying any CryptoVoxels?
I'm not. I've already paper-handed my MiBit, but I kind of want to buy another one now. So, you know, I think that if anything, MiBits will kind of just always go down in history. They are from Larva Labs. Like, everything about them just feels right. So I feel a little naked without a MiBit. So
I do too now. That's a great point, actually. Right? That is the one where you're just like, wow, this is a rig that was ahead of its time. It's Larva Labs.
Larva Labs is always ahead of the game here. I love MiBits as well, Amanda. It's like the lineage of Larva Labs and there's just always going to be that collectability around those things.
Plus, they're the stable
coin. It is kind
of
wild, though. It is kind of wild that this is the place people turn to. Like MiBits, and I kind of said it a bit flippantly, but MiBits is the project that I heard a lot of people start mentioning on the back of this 3D thing, and the floor has just gone from 2.1 to 1.9. So if you guys want one, there's never been a better chance.
Like a stable coin, Sam. Market,
yeah, I call MiBits the stable coin of the NFT space.
I hope they stay there forever.
But that's a 10% down move in a month. That's not stable coin.
Yeah, but I mean,
I'm just saying, like, this news has happened that one would think would be like, okay, like, let's just say attention focused one place. This feels like the right place to focus, and you've just seen the price go lower. So the opportunity for people, this is one of those things where you certainly have not missed it. If you feel like this is the place to go, you're getting pretty good value there right now.
Yeah, it's a great.
Did anything happen with Clonex, Sam? Did anything happen on this news? No.
Down. Clonex has gone from like 3 to 2.6, but they have a whole separate kind of technical situation going on with buyers and sellers there right now.
Yeah, it seems strange because I actually think that Clonex also just has a ton of tools for creators as well. So I think that, you know, we may just be sometimes too early, but I do think that in a bull market, if this whole thing kind of really takes off, both of those are ones to take a look at, as well as, you know, projects that may or may not have, you know, a place in this digital metaverse. Like, I don't know, Moonbirds, I don't know, Monaverse, which will work, you know, on day one. I don't know, maybe, who knows?
Yeah, we've got, that was one of the cool things that came out of this announcement is, you know, Monaverse, who is our partner on the back end, helping us create the Moonbirds little mini metaverse, which is still in development and looking quite cool. I just had a meeting with them yesterday, and Justin and the team over there, not our Justin, their Justin, and it's coming along nicely. Q3 launch, definitely gonna get it out there. Some really fun stuff coming around video streaming out there, display of art. And the cool thing is they built this on Unity.
Yes.
And Apple announced that their entire platform is gonna be on Unity. So out of the box, we're going to be compatible with this device. So you can expect to see, I'm not going to guarantee this because I always get in trouble when I do that. There's some work to be done on the Mona side, obviously, to make this happen, but they're very eager to do this. We're hoping launch day Moonbirds for the actual Apple device, Moonbirds, and that land will be accessible to you right on the device, which will be so much fun.
Totally. And like they've already started articulating that even these Unity-based projects will have all these other benefits that come with the native functionality of the headset. So things like pass-through and high-resolution renderings and native gestures, like these are things that get incorporated into, you know, Unity-based projects right out of the box. And so Justin and his team, there's a whole group of GigaBrains who've come out of Magic Leap and have been thinking about AR and VR for a very long time, are already just like geeking out on all the fun stuff that they're going to be able to do with this.
It's so much fun. I really think that this, I'm hoping, fingers crossed, this is that moment that we've all been waiting for. And if we can have land inside of this world for the Moonbirds, that we can do some fun stuff, and there's a lot of potential there. I don't want to promise anything, but there's a lot of potential, and we're excited to kind of continue to push on that and pressure test it over the next few months as we lead up to this launch. Fidenza had a
I just wanted to say lots of folks in the chat are super excited about this idea about the Vision Pro. They're excited about when it gets to a little bit of a cheaper price point, but understand, you know, how amazing this technology is. Somebody in the chat is asking about the rat. I don't know what he's talking about, but I guess there might be. Is there a rat here? I don't know. Rats.
Remember last week we saw a rat behind you and it ended up being a dog. Oh. So I think that's what they were talking about.
Is that a rat?
Amazing.
Is that actually?
We've had some rat issues here.
There is like a little something back there. I don't know what's going on.
Yes.
There's been something there this whole show. I've been cracking up on and off, like looking at that thing.
It's been back there this whole time. That's amazing.
Yes, okay, we have here's a remote control rat that Mal is just having way too much fun.
Okay,
with.
So Mal, Amanda, here's the backstory. Last week when we saw the rat that ended up being a dog, I literally went on Amazon and bought a mechanical rat, and so I gave it to Mal to just to fuck with you during the show. So
amazing.
I apologize. No, we gotta have perfect. Some fun.
This gotta do it.
Yeah. Too serious sometimes. Yeah.
Fidenza.
To the Fidenza.
Yes. All
right, so big auction coming up June 15th. Everyone's getting really excited. It's 6 days away. It's the Grails, the Three Arrows auction for a lot of really great pieces. We're starting to see some movement on the upper end of Artblocks collections. And there was a 625 ETH sale, the fifth highest sale of all time in ETH terms, for Fidenza.
Let's go.
Fidenza 545 just sold this week. And it's exciting. I mean, it's a beautiful piece. It's a micro. Micro is one of the coveted traits of this collection.
It's a small.
Yeah. Oh, is this a small, not a micro?
It's a small, yeah.
Okay. This is a small. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful piece. And I think folks are starting to get excited about some of the Fidenzas that are getting some bids at the auction coming up. I know there was Sam, you may know this, but an early bid came in for the black and white Fidenza. I think it was about 500 ETH a few days ago, and so we're starting to see some movement here on some pre-bids coming in for the Sotheby's auction, and we're also starting to see some movement at the top end of some of these collections like Ringers and Fidenza and this is, I think, a taste of some of the things to come over the next week.
Here's my baby. I'm never selling this one.
I remember when you bought this. Do you remember?
No, I don't. Were you with me?
I was on
We
were on a call.
So I remember that.
So
yeah.
Fidenza had just minted. Yeah, I had completed minting. You and I had a call about something.
Oh, that's right, 2 years ago. Yeah, I remember. And I remember being like, should I pay 3.8 ETH? And I was like, so expensive.
I remember. And you pulled the trigger, and it's a beautiful piece. Well done, sir.
Yeah.
Damn. Wow. It often feels like we will not be able to get this kind of story, this kind of price action ever again. I think you can see a lot of people in Artblocks who are always trying to be like, this is the next Fidenza. These are the next Ringers. But I think people are way too paper-handed these days. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know that I totally agree with that. I think it's going to be a sleeper, though. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be something that just shoots up and like stays up and to the right. I think it's going to be some artist that we just all kind of sleep on and then all of a sudden wake up when like, I think Mapan was a great example of this, where launched on HIN, launched on Tezos, you know, came out there, reasonable price for a while, kind of under the radar, blew up, and then now is like on the up and up. Like there's a couple artists that, you know, Tyler and Dimitri, those two, and you could probably add one or two to that list in terms of Artblocks artists. Obviously Snow's in there as well, and I'm sure there's a couple more. They're just like, they're iconic, cemented, like they've hit it, you know, at least in the NFT space. Like there's no drop that Tyler couldn't do today and just like completely sell out within minutes at an insane amount of ETH, right? I think there's more coming.
There's more coming.
Yeah.
Dude, this is the story of art and art history. There's always more art. There's always more creative stuff to get created. So I'm excited for the future. It looks like we got something with Mythics.
Yeah. Speaking of creative stuff, we've got our own in-house team hard at work about a month out from the Mythics drop. So we're introducing a video series called the Mythics Chronicles, which we actually tweeted out. You sent a text right away. I appreciate that, being like, this was an awesome video. It's more behind the scenes of the creation process around this whole collection, and all the hard work and effort that goes into it by our team. This is not an outsourced collection. We have in-house artists that have put together some really beautiful stuff. You'll see when the final collection is released. But are we going to roll that video, CT? We're going to roll a little video. Let's take a look at it.
By the way, this is Luke.
Me?
What do you do? Oh, he is a
probably chief fanny pack designer for the Mythics collection. We're not going to have a lot of variety of parts or beaks, but we are going to have a lot of fanny packs. So,
They're now called adventurer packs. He's a senior illustrator. Mm-hmm. Not because he's like really good, just because he's a lot older.
Mm-hmm. what was the forget the name of the trade already. Sour.
Yes. Yes.
I to be completely honest, I hated it at first.
Sour Goose is a piece of art that Luke is developing that's a very specific ugly bill. And I really truly hated it when it first started, but I realized that great art makes you feel something. And I feel a deep sense of hatred.
Well, we started out months ago doing like all variants of familiar Moonbirds-ish beats. And then we started getting a little weirder and we started to like stuff. You know, in a moment of genius, I realized that geese exist and everyone was against it. But I started to draw this and it was the end of the day. I was getting really slap happy and kind of giggling and crying to myself.
I would say Sour Goose is growing on me. I think I'm just so debased that I have nothing left anymore. Like, fine, if this is what we want to do, if this is what works in this space, if this is what's beautiful to people, if this is what we think the world wants, I don't connect with the world, and that's fine.
And the term sour goose came out because it has like a downturn. It doesn't look very happy. It's kind of a bummed expression, but it kicked off. There's a happy goose as well, and this grumpy goose beak, which actually I think is cool, but I had to do a little upsell here to get the team on board.
A little. It works now. We'll see if... It'd be interesting to see what people actually like.
I'm a Sour Goose Maxi. I have been reading this, like, Batman series about... the Court of Owls, and so I had created these masks because you wear them to go to Parliament, and it's like you vote. I was calling it the Parliament mask. Kevin really hated the idea and really squandered the creativity that could have been.
It's back to the original file, at least some of the stuff that got cut, you will know why.
These are going to be fun to roll out over the next few weeks. We've got a lot of great art that is yet to be revealed. I even saw some more of it this morning. So we're doing little tiny glimpses of behind the scenes and some of the art and just, you know, and some of the kind of discussion and debate. And you can tell we're trying to have a lot of fun with this collection.
I love it. I love the editing is great, too. So is that Mal that's doing all that stuff?
Yeah.
It's really good. Good job, Mal.
I'm sure he's got some other team members working on it. I can't say it's fully Mal, but it's been a fun little behind the scenes sneak peek.
All right, we got a very special guest. I've been waiting all episode for this. This is going to be awesome. I'll let you do the intro, but it's you take it away.
Yeah, well, this is David from Sound.xyz, and David, welcome to the show. You know, you're a music industry veteran. Started working at Atlantic Records at 13 years old, and then also Pandora, working on recommendation systems. Really stoked to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, a long time listener, and thank you. I'm very honored to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited because obviously you've known him for a while. Yep. And one of the things that I love to do is, like, we have these verticals within NFTs that are very important. You know, we've got AI, we've got music, we've got a whole slew of different generative, you name it. There's probably 10 that we should be paying attention to. And it's always nice to do check-ins and say, where is the state of the industry? What's going on with music NFTs right now? Why should we be bullish? Why should we be excited? Why should we care? And I keep, every time I mention music NFTs,
they say sound.
It just keeps coming up over and over and over again. So thrilled to have you on.
Yeah.
Do you want to kick things off with some questions?
I'm happy to. And just full disclosure, I've known David for a long time. I think he's brilliant. I'm also an investor in the platform and have been watching him work for the last couple of years in some very positive directions.
In full disclosure, you invest in everything we've ever talked about ever on the show. So
only the good stuff. But David, I would say, you know, something that has, I remember the first time we met, you had such clarity on exactly the consumer behavior that you thought would work for music NFTs. And we, as you kind of look around the space, there's been a lot of experimentation, a lot of trials, a lot of different things that people have done. A lot of platforms that are kind of scoped to different jobs to be done. You have created something that I think now acts as kind of this shelling point, this top of funnel for both, you know, previous artists who make music, but then also Web3 native artists. And so I think it'd be fun, maybe before we get into some of like the most recent stuff, just to talk a little bit about like the design decisions of sound and like the consumer that you thought you were building for and what assumptions you had, because it's all kind of led to this very cool product that has organically grown to be this like industry force in our small corner of the internet.
Yeah, thank you for the extremely kind words. I think one of the things about starting Sound was I really wanted to make sure that any problem that I worked on, I was actually solving the problem. And the last thing that I wanted to do was build something that no one wanted. And so I famously, you know, when I was raising, I said, I'm going to build it in 3 months and get traction. We were 2 weeks off, but we got it done in 3 months and in 2 weeks. And, you know, I was like thinking through, like, you know, I always come back to my two principles in the music industry, and they are like, how do you help artists reach the most amount of people with their music? And I call that music discovery. And how do you help artists make money on their music? I think what my fear was, you know, just trying to put something on chain for the sake of putting it on chain without actually solving one of those two problems. And I think in order to understand Sound, you have to understand those two problems. And the first one is music discovery. And I always say the cost of making music has never been cheaper. You know, you're obviously seeing a lot of these trends with the AI music. It's going to come down to basically zero. But the cost of getting your music heard has never been more expensive. There's more music than ever before that's being put, you know, out there into the world. And in, you know, in the last 20 years, there's been four main music discovery platforms. One is MySpace, two is YouTube, three is SoundCloud, and four is now this thing, TikTok. And TikTok is largely like the concept that anything can go viral at any point is a net positive thing. But the thing about TikTok is it was never really a music platform. It's a video platform. And the way I know that is the video is ultimately what goes viral. And I was super interested in like, how do you incentivize people to check out music? Because what I noticed was like music was moving to the background and people were falling in love with songs, but not necessarily forming these deeper connections with artists. And it was a much different era than when iTunes and vinyl and CDs were around, where people were actually spending money because they actually had to like, consciously think about, hey, you know, what music should I purchase? And so I was really interested in forming this active connection. There's two types of music consumption, active and passive. I was really interested in forming this active connection with music. And the second part, which is more famously talked about, is how do artists make money on their music? I think music is one of the most bizarre art forms of all time because there's one price for every single song. And the music industry has historically had that obsession. You know, iTunes was 99 cents, CDs were $9.99. Spotify is now, you know, closely 0.003 cents per stream. And the question is, where does that number come from? It doesn't even come from listeners or artists. It comes from labels and platforms, which makes me, you know, start to question, is that actually what the market decided to, you know, set it at? And this isn't even, you know, necessarily like the perfect mechanic, but 20 years ago, Radiohead had, you know, this famous album In Rainbows, you know, where they did Pay What You Want. And I was always inspired by that just simply as a mechanic for just putting it in more into the hands of artists and listeners. And I think that was part of the experimentation for you know, what I thought was, you know, really, really exciting about how do we revalue music? I mean, you don't go to a restaurant and there's one price on the entire menu for every item. And how do we start to experiment with how we, you know, value music? And then the final piece is music, you know, I've been fascinated by how like artists can have these huge touring fan bases. You know, it could be a Fish or a Grateful Dead, and you go on Spotify and they have like 300,000 monthly listeners. So it's like where their fans are willing to spend, they can sell out stadiums for the rest of time, but they're not spending money online in a digital sense. And why is that? It's because music is not really an experience. And, you know, the core thing that like, I was like, this is what I'm building. It really, and I haven't talked about it too often, but like, you know, there was this $1 million homepage that was existed a long time ago as well. Another internet experiment. Sound wasn't deeper than the $1 million homepage and SoundCloud comments. I was like, if you need, you know, to have the NFT to leave a comment on the song, let's make that comment section really digital, you know, and scarce. That was it. That was like the first iteration of Sound. I was like very confident I was going to get some initial traction. And, you know, I think the story starts with just making it fun to support and discover music and basically brag and show off. And I've been saying this for a long time, but people heavily underestimate social status and, you know, being able to prove. And I was that, you know, kid on the internet that was always saying, hey, I found Drake before you, but, you know, never had any way to actually prove it. And, you know, Sound was something that I wanted to build for myself. Honestly.
David, I'm curious when you think about collecting the collecting of music and of NFTs, music NFTs. What does the consumer actually own? What do you want them to think about that they actually own when they purchase an NFT? Because I've heard so many different use cases. One is like, okay, I'm collecting it because I'm a fan. I just get to play it and enjoy it. I'm one of the early collectors. There was 100 released. I have that, like you just mentioned, that I found, you know, Drake first or whatever it may be moment. And that's the power that comes from the NFT. Others have been, I'm buying the rights to the NFT, and now I own partial commercial rights. So if this is ever used in a commercial or, you know, in some big ad campaign or played on the radio, I will get royalties. Like, there's been a few of these different models. Where do you land on all of this, and where do you think this is going when it comes to those ownership rights?
Yeah, so we took an approach that, you know, again, obviously this is about empowering artists to own the relationship with their audience. And so we wanted artists to obviously retain their rights, not sell them. And so we stayed far away from that. Also because, you know, consumers don't necessarily, I've never heard an artist receive a DM saying, I wish I owned your masters. And so really it was more around how do you form direct relationships with artists, and how do you kind of, you know, signal that you were there first. And it's really, you know, the you're basically purchasing that direct connection with that artist in some digital format. I kind of, you know, say it's a little bit similar to iTunes, but there's like with three main differences. One is that anyone can listen to the song, and so you're not charging people to listen to the full song, so that, you know, you can maximize the reach of the music. Two is like you're obviously able to contribute whatever you want to contribute. And so I believe in a little bit of this pay, scratching at this pay what you want, which we can dive into. And then three, there, and you know, on the big difference was like there was no way to show off your iTunes purchasing. Like it was, you know, completely isolated. And so there's something really cool that I can look at what Derek's collecting or what Kevin's collecting or what Adam's collecting, and, you know, make it fun and social to basically support an artist through their music. So what you're purchasing is that direct stamp and, you know, that moment of time and that participating in honestly culture when you collect music. And I think we started, and this kind of gets into the backstory of sound, with meeting people with where they're at. People already collect vinyl. They understand scarcity in the physical world and honestly in the digital world as well. And so we started with like a very fixed amount of music NFTs per song. I kind of made it up with the first artist on Sound, Oshi, just picked a random number. But the concept was actually quite deliberate, which was, you know, you go to a club and there's people outside the club and they could let more people in, but they don't. So I was just very focused on if we get these things to sell out, you know, maybe more people will want to come. And so we picked this number 25 because I was like, maybe if we could get 25 people to purchase this, that would be crazy. And it sold out the first day, which it was like the crazy, you know, I never expected, never forget, like the site crashed the first day from too many people trying to purchase. And I was like, what just happened? And then I literally said, I'm going to keep doing that every day till it stops working. And we did it for like, you know, 300 plus days where it just sold out every single day. And that was kind of how we got started. But then I started to get bothered by the fixed editions. And this is something that Derek and I have jammed on, because music is not just about making money. It's also about, you know, reaching people with your audience. And when I got started, one of the big things I said about music was it's about forming a community. Like the concert to me is the holy grail of music experiences. And why is that? I think concerts would be incredibly weird if you went there and it was just you and the artist. It's part of it is being, amongst other fans and other listeners. And so to me, it was really important to build community. And, you know, artists, you know, we started to move past the 25 thing and expand with different, you know, sizes of, you know, editions and whatnot. But then artists would hit me up every day, what price and quantity should I do? And I was like, I have an idea, but, you know, I can't really, you know, give you the perfect price and quantity. And so we started to experiment with, you know, open editions and went down that rabbit hole. And we've been playing around, which we can definitely dive into, with different mint mechanics, because I think one of the things that's really interesting is people understand reach and scarcity and how to create value around scarcity. But reach is also part of the artist's goal. Of course, they want to get a million people to collect their song. And one of the disconnects between music and other art forms is price alone does not dictate a song's success or a song's value. As an example, famously, like there's the Wu-Tang album that sold to, you know, PleaserDAO, and that sold for $3 million. And that's an insane amount of obviously money, but nobody on this call can sing me any of those lyrics. And why is that? It's because not that many people have heard that music. And that's not to say that it's not like, it's still an incredibly powerful way to reshape and revalue music. But I think music is a different, something about music that involves reach that has nothing to do with money. At the same time, artists need to get paid. And I think one of the things about sound is the discovery platforms have always been separated from the monetization platforms. Like you've always had SoundCloud, YouTube, MySpace, TikTok. And I've never been contacted by an artist saying I got rich off SoundCloud, YouTube, TikTok, MySpace. And then you've got the monetization platforms like iTunes and Spotify and, you know, CD stores. And I rarely get contacted saying I'm breaking on iTunes or breaking on Spotify, even 10 years ago. And so the purpose, you know, and something about sound was like, can we break and pay an artist at the same time? Can we grow an artist fan base? And can we pay them all within one place, not having them to choose between the two? And that's something that, you know, we're early on our journey, but obviously we've paid out over $5.3 million in the first, you know, year and a quarter. And I think the breaking part is coming imminently.
Let's spend the remaining part of the conversation on this point, because I think you did a great job teeing up the where you've gone, and now it's where you're going. And something that continues, I think you and I have talked a lot about this, but like the behavior of interacting with sound as it exists today, it's on an environment where it's expensive to transact, it's expensive to interact, it's expensive prohibitively with like how people have interacted with music in the past, and like the costs that they associate with being able to interact with new music or own music, whether it's an album or a digital version of a song or whatever it may be. You wrote this tweet earlier this week called L2 is coming. We think it will unlock a breakout moment for music NFTs. So why don't we unpack a little bit about why you think this shift to L2 for sound in particular is going to be a watershed moment for the industry?
So we started on mainnet, and I was very, again, methodical about, like, I didn't know if anyone wants to collect music on chain. And so I wanted to go with where the action was. And even though obviously like the gas fees were there then, I wanted to kind of isolate. I didn't want to, you know, try two different experiments at once, which is one, does anyone want to collect music? And then two, can we do it on kind of a different chain? So we've been obviously experimenting on mainnet for the last year, which I actually think is really good for startups, and forces you to think about things that really, really matter. Because truthfully, we were able to get a lot of traction even with the gas fees. But I think one of the things is there's different types of games, and that was the most appealing part, that we can't play, you know, on mainnet due to obviously the transaction costs. And then the second part is the narrative was always about supporting artists directly through their music, and obviously, you know, collecting music, and every dollar that gets spent through sound, we obviously want most of it going directly to artists. And when people started to spend more on gas fees and I guess supporting the miners and less on artists, that to me was like the kind of the calling signal that we obviously need to move. And I think one of the things that I, you know, previously kind of shifted my perspective on you know, we need to meet artists with where they're at. And it's too much to ask artists to explain to their fans, some of which know nothing about crypto, what NFTs are, what wallets are, what seed phrases are. And so we wanted to obviously meet them with where they're at and, you know, create solutions that match there. But the most important thing is that there's different minting games that can be played on a layer two that just ultimately aren't feasible on a layer one. And that to me is the most exciting part, is the minting innovation. Because I think mints in general across, obviously my lens is music, but just across the entire, you know, ecosystem, I think there are so many. We started with fixed editions because everyone understands scarcity. Open editions, you know, have had a nice little run. But I think there's so much more experimentation to be done around how do we make collecting as fun as possible. And I think one of the industries that I take a lot of inspiration from is the video game industry, because music and video games used to be quite similar. You know, you used to buy video games for $60 or whatever the price is and, you know, play the video game. And due to like not having the same industry, you know, controls as music, video games have largely pivoted to a free to play and then freemium, you know, pay to upgrade. And music has largely stayed in the same kind of, you know, realm. And I find, you know, one of the things that I've always been interested in, and I think Chris Dixon said this, is like the gap between, you know, content consumption and monetization is the biggest in music. Like music is consumed more than almost any other media form, but the monetization is some of the lowest. And to me, I think that's, you know, some of the games that are going to be unlocked with things like free mints and upgrading and, you know, a lot of fun stuff that we have in the pipeline.
So which L2 did you just choose real quick out of curiosity?
Yeah, we went through a lot of methodical research on this one, and we're actually launching on Monday. So we can definitely break the news here first, but we're going to be launching with Optimism, which is really, really exciting. And I think part of the reason why we were really excited is that they shared a lot of our ideals in terms of, you know, retroactive funding and, you know, really believing in public goods. And then two, I think obviously like the ETH native ecosystem there, was something that we were really, really, really excited about. And so we wanted to create the, I come from a product background, and so I'm maniacal about user experience, and I wanted the least amount of like change between what we currently have. And, you know, it's not perfect by any which means, but obviously everything gets to stay priced in ETH. There's no changes to the contracts.
Right.
There's a minor bridging thing, which we're working on. But other than that, it basically, from a UI perspective, it actually, like, you won't even, like, Derek, I don't even think you'll notice the difference other than a thing, a symbol here and there.
It's interesting. I had a chance to, you know, you don't always get to play with all the L2s that are out there because there's just so many. And I had a chance to interact with Optimism. I can't remember what I was doing, but I remember it being surprisingly efficient and easy to use versus some of the others that I've used. And I was like, wow, this is actually kind of a good experience. Awesome. It's typically bridging and all that other crap. And you're like, you have to wait 35 minutes for the funds to bridge and all this other stuff. It was just like, it could be a nightmare to get consumers to understand how to make that leap. Right. So that's very cool. Well, David, thank you so much for being on the show and bringing us up to speed on all this stuff. We'll continue to, you know, obviously track your project closely. Kent, thanks for dropping a little alpha here on the show. I'm glad that you're continuing to lead the path here and kind of, you know, put a real, I would say you probably consider to be the biggest project in the space is doing music NFTs right. And that's awesome that you've paid over $5 million out to artists and really helped support a lot of these artists. I went to a music NFT meetup here probably 3 months ago with Adam, whose profile I have up here, one of your biggest collectors on Sound. And I had met some artists that had published and actually done things with Sound, and they were like, I made like decent money. Like, this is really helping support these up and coming artists, which is huge.
Good job, David.
Yeah. Thank you, David.
We got a long way to go. I always say we're just getting started.
Very cool. Well, that is it. I think we've covered everything.
That was a good show.
Yeah, it was a fantastic show. What does your art, your rules mean, by the way?
So there's a, so Transient Labs gave this to me. You guys are working with Transient, but yeah. I think it started with an artist named 0xDGB.
Oh, you're a huge fan.
Yeah. So he's played with this idea of your art, your rules in the past. Transient put it on a cap. I rock it all the time now. It's one of my favorite caps.
Love it. Well, happy Friday, everyone out there. Amanda, everything good on your end before we say goodbye? Thank you for your help. Anything for last minute thoughts from the community?
I will say, you know, Mal has kind of created a monster here. We've got Trey Ratcliffe in the chat. None of the things that he said I can repeat on air. But thank you, Trey, for making me laugh in the chat. You're hilarious. Maybe I might be able to repeat something next week. We'll see.
Yeah, Trey is a beloved community member, and it depends on the time of day you catch him. He can say some wild stuff. He's an experimenter. So Trey, love you, and he's so fun. I've known Trey for a long time, way before NFTs. Well, thank you, David, for being on the show as well, and thank you, Sam, for your help on the show. Derek, always good to see you.
Always
Amanda,
great
to see you, and we'll see you all again next week. Have a great weekend.
Take care, gang.
Let's go.